You are listening to Written in the Stars, Books and Beyond, where hosts from the LCC Library sit down with writers, publishers, entrepreneurs, and literary enthusiasts of all types. Join us as we explore the very heart of the written word.
Hello, and welcome to Written in the Stars. Today, we are talking about the subject of book bans and censorship. And according to the American Library Association, in 2024, there were 2,452 unique titles that were challenged, making it the third highest number ever documented by the ALA. And that also significantly exceeded the annual average of 273 unique titles from 2001 to 2020 that were challenged. So, challenging times, and Michigan is not immune to these challenges either. So today, my co-host John Saligi and I have a guest here to help us better understand book bans and their impact. Please welcome to the show from the organization My Right to Read, Amber
Sheeran, like Ed.
Just like Ed. Welcome to the show, Amber.
Welcome, Amber.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'll go ahead and get started. So we're going to kind of start at the beginning. So, Amber, tell us, what's the difference between a book ban and a book challenge?
That's a great question. And honestly, it depends on who you ask. So the American Library Association, or ALA, defines it a little bit differently than PEN America defines it or other organizations define it. We tend to go with the ALA definition, but again, it depends on who you ask. So a banned book is a book that is inaccessible to people. It has been removed from the shelves. It has been taken out of the collection. It has been made so that certain folks or a community are unable to access it. A challenged book is a book that is somewhere in that process. So it is fair, and any patron is able to challenge a book, is able to go to their librarian and say, hey, I want to ask why this book is on the shelf, or I don't like this book, I want it removed. You have the right to do that as a patron of a library. You have a right to challenge that book. It becomes banned when it actually is removed for other people. So again, we like to say that you can challenge it. That's part of a democratic society, is you get to, you know, redress your grievances to your government. You're allowed to bring that up. But when it's challenged, it goes through a process, typically called a process of reconsideration, where the library director, the library staff will review that material and determine whether it should be removed from the collection. And there is, most libraries have a process for that. So that would be kind of how you define it. But again, it depends on kind of who you ask. PEN America is a little bit more broad. They define most challenged books as banned. Their definition's a little bit broader.
So you've mentioned a couple of times about PEN America. What is that organization, and what does PEN stand for, I guess?
I don't know what PEN is an acronym for, but okay. They are another organization that works on a national basis. They collect data on banned books, on censorship. They do a lot of the similar work as American Library Association, just different organization, but they also help protect First Amendment and help protect the right to read and promote literacy and literature across the country.
So one other kind of follow-up question. You mentioned a little bit about any patron can go in and challenge a book and talk to the library about that. And you mentioned a little bit about the process, but what do processes in a library kind of look like if a patron does come in and challenge a book? What does the library's process often look like?
So most libraries, I want to say all libraries have, but that's not necessarily true. Most libraries have, and all libraries should have, what is referred to as a collection development policy, which dictates what books are put on the shelf and when books are weeded out of a collection. So weeding a book out means that, you know, there is a finite amount of space on a shelf, so you need to review that collection. You find materials that might be out of date, or maybe a book that just hasn't been checked out in 20 years, and you decide that material doesn't need to take up that space on the shelf, and it gets weeded out. So libraries should have a policy, again, for collection development to determine which books they buy, what they add to their collection, and then when books should be removed, when they should be weeded. Part of that policy should also include a request for reconsideration policy, which is to say what that process looks like. And I'll just speak very broadly, because every library is going to write that policy a little bit differently. But generally, it will say, you know, you can bring a book to your librarian and say, I have questions about this book. I want to know, you know, why is it here? And then oftentimes you can refer back to that collection development policy and say, this is why we have that book. You know, different libraries have different collections, a public library versus an academic library. Some libraries have a special collection of a certain kind of material that they might have more of. So you can refer back to that policy and say, this is why we have this book. And if that patron says, well, you know, I don't like this book. I think this book is inappropriate. I want it taken off the shelves. Then what most libraries will do is have them fill out a form that says why, you know, explaining the reasoning they might object to in that material. And generally, we ask that the patron has read that in its entirety, that they don't just find one swear word on one page and say this entire book has to go. But we ask, read it in its entirety, and if you still have a problem with it, let us know why. Generally, then the librarian will read that material, review it, and then determine whether it does adhere to that collection development policy, whether it is material that warrants being in the library. And ultimately, in most cases, for a public library, that will go to its board of directors for a final decision. The board of directors set those policies. They determine the policies of the library. But it really is the trained librarians and library directors that should be the ones that review and make sure that that material adheres to the policy that that library has for the materials within their collection.
That's good information. And to kind of clarify, too, and like you're saying, every library kind of has their own collection development policy, mm-hmm. and there's different types of libraries. So just because a book is banned or challenged in one library system, you might find it in two towns over in their public library.
Very likely.
So what are some common reasons that a book is challenged or ultimately then banned maybe from that system?
So I will say, you know, books have been challenged and banned for thousands of years. As long as libraries have existed, books have been banned from them or challenged from them. So throughout time, the reasons behind those have changed. Speaking in contemporary times, books are most often challenged due to what people might view as objectionable material, depictions of sex. It's often depictions of LGBTQIA characters or storylines. Those are often targets for banning, as are depictions of marginalized groups, and often sometimes historical facts. You know, there's been some controversy of what do you teach in classrooms, and often those book banning trends kind of follow that. So people that maybe don't want some of the uglier parts of maybe American history taught also don't want those books in their public library. But I would say currently the number one reason books are challenged is based on gender, sexual identity, or orientation. And it's often framed in the way of protecting children from that material, even though in most instances that material is not meant for children in the first place. So that would be kind of, again, it depends on what you're looking at in the specific community, but those are some of the trends that we're seeing.
So I guess, can you talk a little bit more about when a book is challenged or ultimately banned, like the impact then that can have, say, on communities or libraries or individuals?
Absolutely. So I think speaking in terms of individuals, if a book is challenged because a character identifies, has a certain identity, be it sexual orientation, sexual identity, racial background, national origin, it tells people of that community that their stories don't matter as much. It tells people that they don't deserve a place on that library shelf. But it also impacts other people that might pick up that book and read it and not be a part of that community to better have a window into that viewpoint, to see different perspectives. And I think often it impacts our ability to develop empathy for people that are different than ourselves if we don't have access to those stories about them and those viewpoints. It can impact a lot, you know, how we see ourselves, how we see others. And I think we live in a very polarized world, and it only aims to, in many instances, continue to make us more polarized if we are not able to better understand the stories of others.
So you talked a little bit about the kind of polarization in that, but something that's interesting about book challenges and kind of these kind of speech topics is sometimes they don't really follow the like political dichotomy that we have. Like there's challenges from from both sides.
Absolutely,
and
absolutely.
It doesn't necessarily adhere to like a single political ideology. So
absolutely.
I didn't know if you had any thoughts about that.
There's a quote. We actually, in the My Right to Read store, we have a t-shirt that has this quote on it that says, a good library should have something in it that offends everyone. So I think, again, every library should have materials that offer a wide range of viewpoints. And so you're right. Sometimes challenges, it's not a left thing or a right thing. It does come from all sides. But I think we need to better, everyone on every side of every spectrum needs to be able to see and understand others so that we can continue to grow together as a community.
I think it's interesting, too, as you were talking about, thinking about how, because book bans and challenges have been around for a very long time, and thinking of the reasons that they're challenged kind of sometimes reflects what's happening in society and the conversations and things that are being, you know, going
Absolutely.
On around us. So I think sometimes we see that in the challenges that we see as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, you brought up at the beginning the ALA data about the books, and you're right, you know, prior 2011 through 2020, it was averaging about 250 unique titles per year were challenged nationwide. The American Library Association collects this data. And then starting in 2021, that number jumped up to, I think it was 1,800. And then the next year, it was 2,500. And I think it only, again, reflects the broader community that we live in and a difficulty that all sides have on relating to people that might be different than themselves.
Right, that polarization. So tell us a little bit about the organization, My Right to Read. So
yes.
Tell us kind of what does that mean, and tell us a little bit about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so we're in Michigan. So it's MI, like Michigan, Right to Read. So we are a component of the Michigan Library Association. So the Michigan Library Association has been an organization since 1891. We've been around for a very long time, and the primary goals of the Michigan Library Association are to advocate for libraries, to make sure that libraries throughout the state, whether they be public, academic, tribal libraries, special libraries, are funded and supported in whatever ways they need. So we offer professional development for library workers. We offer advocacy at the state level. And we hope to, again, foster a stronger network of libraries. We work very closely with the Library of Michigan that has the Michigan e-library, interlibrary loan, where you can get materials. Again, if your collection development policy doesn't have a certain title on your shelf, you can borrow it from the library a town over that might have it. So we work on that. And again, seeing this exponential rise in book banning in America around 2020, we really saw that that was our imperative. That was something that we needed to work on more heavily. So in 2021, we launched My Right to Read as an arm of the Michigan Library Association. And this arm really aims to speak not just to those folks working in libraries, but to the broader public as a whole, to educate folks about book banning, to educate folks about censorship and, you know, your First Amendment rights to access information. We think that that is critical to any democratic society, that you should be able to access information. And so we, again, since 2021, have worked on this initiative to be more public facing. And we offer, again, information to the public, but also training for libraries to help them develop those collection development policies if they don't have it, to teach them about what are their obligations to their community. And then we also offer financial support to libraries that might be facing legal challenges. In Michigan and throughout the country, there has been a push in recent years from some, and I will say it is limited in Michigan compared to some other states, but there has been a push to criminalize librarianship in some ways that, you know, if you don't like the book that's on the shelf, hold that librarian legally responsible for that. There have been prosecutors that have gone after librarians. There have been librarians that have lost their job. And so if there is a legal issue at hand, we are there to help provide funds to libraries to help support that mission and adhere to those pillars of librarianship and support the First Amendment.
So you mentioned a little bit about legislation mostly in other states for criminalizing parts of librarianship, but there's also been other legislation in other states as well, kind of protecting the rights of librarians and of the right to read.
Yes.
And so have there been similar, I guess, pushes in the legislature in both regards in Michigan?
There have been. So I don't know if it was the last legislative session or the session before that. I'd have to double check my facts. But there was a push to essentially make a sectioned off area in libraries where you would put what would be deemed as objectionable materials. There was no definition of what those materials were, but it basically said you have to have a curtain in your library and you have to hide materials back there where some people in the public can't access it. That was not great legislation. We worked really hard against that, and luckily it didn't go anywhere. And I will say, legislators on both sides of the aisle kind of said, I don't think we want this to be legislation in Michigan. There are actually two bills right now in the House, sponsored by Representative Pies and Representative Glanville, the My Right to Read bills. And so they were first introduced in the last legislative session, and they timed out and they died in our lame duck session. But when the new legislative session opened, they were reintroduced, and they have been assigned to a committee, but they have not seen a lot of momentum. So we do hope that they move forward, but time will tell on that. And those bills require a library to have a collection development policy. Like I said, they all should, but they don't all necessarily. It requires that they have that. It also requires that people that are challenging books come from the service area of that library. So what we have seen throughout the country is people that might, you know, people in Tennessee or in New York or California challenging books in Michigan libraries. They just pick a list of libraries and they, you know, there's a specific title or 20 specific titles they don't want in any library anywhere. And so it dictates that in order for a challenge to be investigated, for a book to be reviewed, it has to come from somebody within the service area, an actual patron of that library. It also would prevent a book from being challenged more than once. I believe it's every 2 years. So what we also have seen is that a book is challenged, it is read, it is reviewed, it is determined by the library director and by the board to fit with the collection development policy to not be, you know, obscene material. And then immediately someone that doesn't like that result challenges it again. And they have to go through this whole process again, which takes time out of the librarian's day that they can't spend on programming for their patrons, they can't spend on actually the fundamentals of their job. And then it also takes money. You know, they get paid. Librarians don't do it. It's not a volunteer position. So that's money that the taxpayers are spending for them to review these same books over and over again. And so what it does, it says once it has been reviewed, a decision has been made. The board, you know, okays that decision, the library director, and there's rationale behind it. You have to wait a certain amount of time before you can challenge it again, just so that those librarians aren't just spinning their wheels over and over again. So again, it's two bills. They're tie-barred together. One speaks to public libraries, one speaks to district libraries, but the wording is essentially exactly the same. And those are in the Michigan House right now. And so I would encourage folks to reach out to the representatives to help push those bills forward.
So you mentioned one thing, another kind of legal thing as you were going through that, of things being deemed not obscene.
Yes.
And so could you explain a little bit about what obscenity is and what that means?
Absolutely. So I think the famous quote is like, you can't define it, but you know it when you see it. But there actually is a definition for obscenity. And it goes back to, it's a Supreme Court case, and I don't know the year, but it was Miller v. somebody, because the end result of that is called the Miller test. And the Miller test determines whether something is deemed to be obscenity or not. And the Miller test has three prongs to it. And material has to hit all three prongs. So the first one is it of prudent interest. Basically, in not using legalese, it means, does this material make you think about sex? The second one is it patently offensive? Would a reasonable person look at this and be reasonably offended by that material? And the third is, does the material in its entirety lack literary, scientific, artistic merit? So is, you know, again, if you look at, there's lots of books. I know romance novels are big these days that maybe have one or two pages that might be a little spicy. But if you read that material in its whole, does it wholly lack artistic and literary merit? A book, movie, whatever the material is, has to hit all three of those things to be considered obscene legally. I will say it's also, it's illegal to buy obscene material. So libraries don't really have it, because if it fails that Miller test, they're not going to buy it.
I think you just spoke to, too, as to why it's so important to read the entire book in its entirety rather than just that page.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure. So you mentioned, too, a few things about how people can get involved. And you mentioned contacting, you know, your representatives and things like that. What are some other ways, and maybe through your organization, that people could become an advocate?
Yeah. So there is some information on the My Right to Read website. So it's mirighttoread.com. You can also go to milibraries.org, which is the main page for the Michigan Library Association. You can find your way to My Right to Read through there. There is information out there about how to become more involved, what you might like to do. But just as a basic level, I think, again, contacting your representatives, letting them know that, you know, you support legislation for the right to read and you support your library. You can attend library board meetings. I think some people think it might not be the most fun thing, but nefarious things often happen in the shadows. And so if you aren't paying attention to what's happening, it's good to go and attend and speak up. Speak in support of your library. On the My Right to Read website, you can also join our coalition where you know, we don't send out a lot of emails. We don't fill your inbox. But if there is an issue that pops up in your backyard in your local library, we will let you know, like, your library is facing this challenge, is facing this issue, so you can become a coalition member there to support your library. And I think at a very basic level, if you don't already have a library card, go get a library card for your local library. Just having that card goes into the data that gets fed to the state that shows, like, people are interested in their libraries, they're supporting their libraries, and it really, even if you rarely check out materials, having that library card does make more of a difference than you think it does.
That is excellent advice, and I would advocate highly for that,
yeah,
too. Definitely get your library cards. And I would also add to that, you know, talk to a librarian.
Oh, yes.
There's a lot of misconceptions in this profession that, you know, we read books all day.
Yeah. The number of times that I've heard, like, working in a library must be great. You just get to sit around and read all day.
Yeah. I want that job, too. But, you know, that's a pretty big misconception. So I would say talk to your librarians, too, and, you know, see what they have to say about book challenges and, you know, why this book was purchased and things like that.
I think most librarians would be more than happy to talk to you. If you have questions, they want to talk to you about that. And if you have, again, whether it's good or bad, you know, if you have questions or concerns or comments, please, yes, talk to your librarian, ask them, and you'll find that they're going to be more than happy to talk to you about these issues.
That's awesome. So this is all great information that you've given us today, Amber. But so I have one last question for both of you before we wrap it up today. So, Amber, what's your favorite banned book?
What is my favorite banned book?
Favorite?
That is a great question. So right now I have several, but the very first one that pops in my head is The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Oh, great book. That has been
banned a lot lately. Yeah. And that came out when I was in high school, and I remember reading it in high school and it just hitting me, you know, in all the right places. And I loved that book. And so that was difficult to see that one challenged and see that one banned, because that one really impacted me a lot at a time when that was the book I needed to read.
Yeah, that one hit me too, and I kind of it found its way into my hands at the right moment, right?
Yeah.
Which is when it's a really good book, right?
Yeah.
It just hits at the right time.
Yeah, I also just want to add too, I think the banning of books also speaks to an issue of equity and access, because a library might ban a book, but that book is more than likely still going to be available on Amazon, and so people that have the means often can still get it. It's the folks that don't have those means that are most impacted by book banning. And so it's an issue of equity that I think is often overlooked in that conversation.
That's a really good point. Really good point. So, John, what's your...
So I guess my choice would be a book that kind of came onto my radar at the right time as well, and is controversial for lots of reasons nowadays, and that's Harry Potter. So, you know, there has been all kinds of challenges to Harry Potter, from the content of the book to the views of the author. But my experience with Harry Potter, I first read the Harry Potter books when I was in college, and getting a degree in English and reading like serious literature and that kind of thing. And my cousins who were elementary school age had the Harry Potter books. And we went to visit them one Thanksgiving, and I read the first three books like over Thanksgiving weekend, and then quickly the fourth one. So Harry Potter would be mine.
Gotcha. Yeah. Mine I would offer up is To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, great book.
Yeah, great book. And I'm so sad that others would not get to share in that book.
Yeah.
So, yes. Well, thank you so much, Amber, for being here. Gave us a lot of great information today, and we really appreciate having you on our show today.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, and you can check out myrighttoread.com if you'd like to hear some more information. And we'll also have everything listed out in our show notes today, too. Thank you for being here, Amber.
Thank you so much, Johnny.
Thanks.
You have been listening to Written in the Stars, Books and Beyond. Visit lcc.edu/library to find the titles discussed in this episode. You can find previous episodes of Written in the Stars and other LCC Connect shows at lccconnect.com. In the words of Miguel de Unamuno, I hope, reader, we shall meet again and we shall recognize each other.
Featuring the staff, faculty, students, and others that helped to make Lansing's Premier College what it is today. You're listening to LCC Connect. To find out more about our featured programs or to listen on demand, visit us at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Overseen by experienced LCC faculty, the Lansing Community College Massage Therapy Clinic provides an opportunity for LCC students to hone their skills. The 18-table massage facility is open to the public and provides each client with their own isolated area. Visit lcc.edu/massage for more information.
The Lansing Community College Foundation provides scholarships that make education possible, change students' lives, and uplift our community. Students may apply for scholarships November 1st through January 31st. Learn more at lcc.edu/scholarships.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
From the watchmen of ancient cities to the rise of modern police forces, and from medieval dungeons to today's correctional institutions, our systems of law enforcement and punishment have shaped societies for centuries. Welcome to Silver and Blue, tracing the history of policing and corrections, the podcast where we will uncover the beginning to the present of policing and corrections. Each episode will explore how justice was enforced, how punishment evolved, and what these legacies mean for us today. Let's step back in time and see how order and disorder came to be. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm your host, Tammy McDermott, and today we will move forward in the BC era and talk about the next in our civilizations that were influential in establishing law, policing, and corrections. The next place in our tour is ancient Greece, where many of the ideas we take for granted today were just beginning to form. The Greeks didn't invent justice, but they did reshape it, transforming it from a personal matter into a public institution, and in the process, laying foundations that still influence modern legal systems. Last episode, we were in Egypt in the 2nd century BC. Now let's travel to between 700 to 300 BC and begin learning about another evolution of law, policing and corrections through ancient Greece. To understand Greek law, imagine a society before written statutes, before courtrooms, before judges. Early Greek justice was rooted in custom and tradition, passed down orally and enforced through family networks. If someone harmed you, it was your responsibility to respond. Justice was personal, and retaliation, sometimes violent, was expected. This one important thing to understand about ancient Greece: it wasn't one country. As Greece grew in its own group of people into sections or valleys, these eventually became city-states. To attempt to get a handle on how extensive ancient Greece was, you would have to look at a map and realize that many civilizations can be traced back to the Neolithic and Bronze Age, between 3200 to 1000 BCE, with people like the Minoans and the Mycenaeans thriving during this time. The Trojan War also took place during this time. As the centuries progressed, the Grecian Empire grew and expanded beyond the islands to encompass great swaths of land that would start to grow. As we get into the time period we will focus on, the way the Greeks settled were in these city-states, places like Athens, Corinth, Argos, and Sparta, all operated as separate and independent of each other. Depending on which century, there was a variety of ways that each city-state might be governed. Monarchy was prominent in some, with a king and council to rule. For places like Sparta, they relied on oligarchy, two men, both with limited authority to rule. An oligarchy that existed in Athens is where we will head to first. That oligarchy at that time appointed one of the ruling members to codify the laws and add what he deemed necessary. Well, that doesn't sound good. And it wasn't. That person was Draco. He was an Athenian lawgiver whose name still echoes in a word we've all heard before, draconian. What made this period important was that Draco's laws were written down and also publicly displayed. For the first time, the rules of society were visible to everyone. Law was no longer the private knowledge of aristocrats. It became a shared reference point, a foundation for civic life. Now, many of you have heard the word draconian. As just mentioned, it refers to the laws that were put into effect by Draco during the 7th century. But it wasn't the laws that were harsh. The laws are the same as some we have already encountered in previous podcasts. Theft, adultery, corruption, etc. It was the punishment that resulted from breaking the laws. Unlike other civilizations covered so far, where the common punishment was fines, punishment here was death for almost everything from theft to murder. While surprisingly, the only true proof of Draco's laws today is in the complete written law for homicide, many of the other presumed laws, while attributed to Draco, have no proof of existence. Check this week's show notes for more on Draco and the laws he is famous for. A generation later, into the 6th century, Athens turned to another reformer, Solon. Where Draco had been strict, Solon was strategic. He understood that Athens was on the brink of social collapse. Economic inequality, political tension, and widespread debt slavery that threatened the city's stability. Solon's reforms were sweeping. He abolished debt slavery, which was common practice. If you owed money, you could be enslaved if you could not pay it back. Solon did this by canceling existing debts. Next, he reorganized political classes, all based not on birth, which had been the custom, but on wealth. This meant that lineage no longer determined political power. This meant allowing for the lower classes to have a voice, which meant helping to decide what happened in society. And when it came to the legal system, Solon replaced the harshness of Draco's laws with balanced and humane laws. Citizens now had rights, including appealing decisions to a jury court. He didn't create democracy, but he laid the groundwork for it by giving ordinary Athenians greater access to justice. Solon also encouraged public participation in legal matters. If you witnessed a crime, you were expected to speak up. Justice became a shared responsibility, not just a government function. It was during this time Solon was making the changes, another thing came as a result of this. Due to the shift of justice from the few elites to the wider citizenry, Athenian law had evolved into a system unlike anything else in the ancient world. Trials were held before large juries, sometimes numbering in the hundreds. Can you imagine a jury in the hundreds? We can hardly seat 12. There were no professional lawyers at this time. Citizens got to argue their own cases, often with speeches crafted by professional writers. Can you imagine citizens arguing their own cases? What a circus! These trials were dramatic, emotional, and deeply public. They weren't just determining guilt or innocence. They were about reinforcing the values of the community. The courtroom became kind of a civic theater where Athenians performed their identity as citizens. Law, in this sense, wasn't just a set of rules. It was a cultural expression of what it meant to belong to the polis, or society. Well, now that we have the foundations of law in ancient Greece, let's shift from law to policing. To do that, we have to set aside our modern assumptions. Ancient Greece did not have a centralized police force. There were no uniformed officers patrolling the streets, no investigative units, and no detectives. Because ancient Greece was made up of different city-states, each handled order and crimes the same, but different. The main concept for Greece was that maintaining order was a shared civic duty. As you recall, Greek city-states were small, tightly knit communities. Citizens were expected to regulate themselves and each other. Think neighborhood watch on steroids. A large armed force controlled by the state would have been seen as a threat to freedom. So let's think about that concept. What about how things are done now? So policing emerged in a very different form, one that blended civic responsibility, public officials, and in some cases, enslaved labor. Remember, enslaved labor during ancient times was not unheard of. The closest thing to a formal police force in ancient Greece appeared in Athens during the 5th century BCE. The city employed a group of 300 Scythian slaves, often called archers or rod bearers. Well, those were clubs, by the way. Their role was practical, not investigative. They maintained order during public gatherings, like parades or king's gatherings. They guarded government buildings, managed prisoners. They carried out arrests, assisted magistrates in enforcing the regulations of the city-state. These individuals were chosen precisely because they were not citizens. Because they were enslaved, they were not part of the Grecian society. They had no political loyalties, no family ties, and no reason to favor one Athenian over another. Their neutrality made them effective enforcers of public order. Even with the Scythian archers, policing in Athens relied heavily on citizens. Remember, Scythian archers handled practical tasks. For example, if your home was robbed, you didn't call the police. You investigated the crime yourself. You gathered evidence, found witnesses, and brought the case to court. If an arrest was to be made, then the Scythian archers would be called to make an arrest. It was this system that reinforced a core Greek belief: freedom comes with responsibility. To be a citizen was to be an active guardian of the community. Now, this is an example of only what Athens did. Other city-states had their own approaches. Sparta, for example, developed the Kryptia, a secret organization of young Spartan men who acted as internal enforcers. Their primary role was to control the population, sometimes through violence. This was policing as social control, not public service. As I mentioned earlier, because Greece was broken into city-states, policing reflected the values and priorities of each polis, society, and city-state. So now we know corrections in ancient Greece looked nothing like modern systems. The Greeks did not use prisons as punishment. Instead, they saw imprisonment as a temporary measure, a way to hold someone until a trial, ensure payment of a fine, or enforce compliance with a court order. There was a main reason prisons were not used as punishment. The Greeks believed punishment should be visible, immediate, and public. A prison sentence didn't achieve that. It hid the offender away and consumed resources without benefiting the community. So, to Greeks, punishment happened outside the prison walls. So let's see what this punishment actually looked like. First up, fines were the most common form of punishment. They were flexible and could be scaled to the offense. So what the offender did could be taken into consideration when the fine was being levied. Well, that's a novel thought, However, failure to pay a fine could lead to temporary imprisonment or loss of your rights. However, on the other end of the spectrum, exile was one of the harshest penalties in Athens. To be exiled was to lose your home, your community, and your identity as a citizen. In a society where citizenship was central to personal identity, exile was devastating. Athens also practiced ostracism, a unique form of temporary exile. Once a year, citizens could vote to banish someone for 10 years, not for a crime, but for being a potential threat to the state. It was a political safety valve designed to prevent tyranny. We will find this in common as we work our way through the ages moving forward. Exile becomes less harsh, depending on the time in society, but it still took you away from family and community, which was still a central part of who people were in this time. Some punishments were designed to humiliate rather than harm. A person might be forced to stand in a public place, wear certain symbols, or pay fines publicly. These penalties reinforced community norms and discouraged repeat offenses. Think, do we do those kinds of things now? Last, execution was rare, but used for serious crimes like treason or sacrilege. Physical punishment was more common in militaristic states, like Sparta, where discipline and obedience were central to the society. Ultimately, Greek corrections wasn't about rehabilitation. They were about protecting the community, preserving order, and reinforcing civic identity. Punishment was a tool for maintaining the balance of the polis, or society. That wraps up today's episode on ancient Greece and how they'd established law, policing, and corrections. On our next episode, we're going to take our journey to ancient Rome. I hope you'll join me. That wraps up today's episode of Silver and Blue, tracing the history of policing and corrections. This podcast is produced by LCC Connect. You can listen to other podcasts in the LCC Connect family by going to lccconnect.com. If you want to listen to this podcast on demand, go to lccconnect.com and visit the Silver and Blue webpage. Until next time, keep questioning, keep learning, and keep the dialogue alive.
Keep connected with LCC Connect at lccconnect.org.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
The Center for Veteran and Family Support at Lansing Community College welcomes veterans and military-connected students. Visit lcc.edu and search Veteran Services to find out more information.
Lansing Community College's School of Business incorporates areas of study including marketing, insurance, management, and more. Transfer options and direct degree options are both available depending on the area of study. To find out more about LCC's business programs, visit lcc.edu.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Conversations with Kate is like a conversation with your friend, hairstylist, or therapist, where we will talk about music, life, stories, and everything in between, with interviews and guests sprinkled in. As an LCC student, it's an honor, and I love bringing a fresh perspective to the podcast menu on LCC Connect. I am your host, Kate. Let's get into this episode. All right, welcome into this episode. So grateful to talk to you today about voices that inspire. We're going to go first with the actual definition of inspiration. It's the process of being mentally stimulated to do or feel something, especially to do something creative. And who in your life or what in your life defines that for you? What does inspiration really mean? What is it and how is it defined in everyday terms? Not just the big breakthroughs, but quiet nudges that shift our perspective. Inspiration can come through and arrive through conversations, unexpected moments, and simple observations. Something as simple as, you know, watching your child or your grandchild play outside, or watching them learn and kind of clutch in on something that they have been working on or trying, or yourself for that matter. And sometimes that is just those nudges, that little moment of, ooh, hey, that kind of just, you know, lit me up inside. I go through a lot of that with my spiritual practice stuff, with kind of just paying attention to your intuition. And again, those nudges. I also live and die by that when it comes to music. I sometimes will just get like a spark of an idea for a mix or a piece of music, and I'll go from there. Sometimes that looks like I just was on Spotify and having my day list give me, there's a couple of different ones that I've actually saved of vocal or funky liquid drum and bass. And I'm like, ooh, hey, I haven't heard that tune before, and saving it. And that's a little bit of, or a tiny snippet of everyday inspiration, and not just in terms of like, ooh, there's this person out there that inspires me, or there's this goal that inspires me type of thing, which I think is really important that we find those small moments of inspiration every day. And sometimes it can be just, you know, you are working towards a goal of, let's just say, for example, you know, running. That's one of the things I've been working on in recent months, is being able to actually run for longer periods of time. Because as much as I like to be, you know, healthy and active at the same time there. You don't mind, do you? Let's just mix up words together. But for instance, I am working on being able to run for a longer period of time. And this recent thing was, I was able to run for just a little bit longer than I was able to run before. And just having that moment of like, oh my God, I'm still going, and I don't feel gassed. And, you know, here I am, like, actually doing it. And that, not only is that just a everyday moment of inspiration, but it's that fuel, that nudge to kind of keep going and to try a little bit harder and to not give up on that thing. My goal is to ultimately one day run a 5K. We're not quite there yet, but I'm working on it. I'm following those little nudges and all those little baby steps of getting there. Again, that was just a little example of everyday inspiration. If there's something that you have that's an everyday inspiration, whether it be, you know, figuring out that sourdough recipe or working out or writing or whatever. If there's some kind of everyday inspiration, please share it with me. I love to hear what you have to say. Then we can move on to the people that have shaped us. Who has influenced you? Who are your mentors? Was it your family members? Was it a friend of yours? Was it an artist, whether it be music or art? Actual like painting or drawing or even just brief encounters with people, because inspiration can come from any or all of those. Some people that have inspired me personally just over the years, when I was younger and I played basketball, Michael Jordan was big for me. My mom knew that, you know, I watched as much as I could of his games when I was younger and playing ball. And as a teenager, it was more in the realm of musical artists that inspired me. So being a 80s baby, I absolutely was inspired by Madonna. And this started as young as being a toddler. Those are some of my earliest memories, was listening to Lucky Star on our big floor TV. And then memorizing like all the moves from the music video, and then forcing, you know, come and be like, Mom, Dad, Tim, forcing my older brother, my mom, and my dad to sit on the couch and watch me perform her songs. I remember loving to wear this pair of jean suspenders, and I loved it so much because the buckles made noise. That's, you know, again, that's just a couple of different people that in different ways that have inspired me. As far as like actual music now that inspire me, man, there is a lot. I recently have met some students with me here in the music program that really, really inspire me. Micah, you are one of them because you play the violin flawlessly. If you're listening and hear this, Micah, thank you. As well as playing the piano. All of my teachers here, Professor G, Nada, my voice lessons professor, Professor Jones, and Dr. Zakirov, my keyboard harmony professor. They've all really truthfully, in this new avenue of music exploration and music education, that have truly inspired me all in their own ways. Professor Jones really, really taught me that grounded electronic mixing, mastering forefront, which I knew a little bit of base knowledge on working in DAWs for music production, but I didn't know and didn't have that knowledge. So he really inspired me with the way that he taught that class on how to appropriately master tracks. Professor G, man, I owe him a ton as far as music theory is concerned. He really broke it down and inspired me to come back to class excited and hungry for more knowledge on the subject matter. So other ways that he inspired me, he's a really great artist. He plays the saxophone and he's put out music on Spotify. He also does jazz band, and those are ways that he's inspired me outside of the classroom. Nada, she has been the heart of my vocal inspiration. She herself is a very prolific opera singer. She sang everywhere. If you would like to get to know her, please go look her up. Again, her name is Nada Radakovic. And Dr. Z, he is a phenomenal piano player. And that professor, he was able to get me. Now, mind you, I went to a performing arts school in high school, and my piano class, I barely got through that class by the skin of my teeth with a C. And Dr. Sakirov was able to break it down and be patient enough and explain the piano enough to where I now can play with both hands. And that's why I couldn't ace that class in high school is because I could not, for whatever reason, could not get it together to play with both hands together. So again, thank you so much to the music department staff here for your inspiration as well. There are other music-wise people that have inspired me. My dad, he is a singer-songwriter, so it's kind of in the DNA. He's super duper talented, both with instrumentation and with writing songs. Maybe I'll have him on here one of these days and we'll get a chance to talk to him, you and I together, because he's really good at what he does. Maybe I'll have him bring his guitar and play. Other people in the music arena that have inspired me, there's of course pop artists, but the others that truly have stuck with me for drum and bass and the music that I play, there's a lot. There's currently the ones that are in rotation for inspiration for doing electronic music and sticking to it and that kind of thing is John Summit, Diplo. There's a couple of others. Females that inspire me in the industry, there is so many. But Erica Strife, she is a fantastic American drum and bass DJ. Colette Warren, she is a phenomenal singer in the electronic music industry. Her boyfriend, as well as there's so many, Hybrid Minds, K-Motions, Charlotte Haining. There's just a ton. I wish I could sit here and just kind of like go over all of them. But Brian G from V Recordings, he has several labels. My hometown crew in the drum and bass scene there, the Torque members, love you guys. Kevin Harrell, all those people that play there regularly and the people that come to the events regularly, they're all doing great things these days. And again, those are just the people music-wise that inspire me. Artists, Monet, oh, music-wise that inspire me, Vivaldi. I could listen to Vivaldi all day long, every day, especially his strings, things, and Chopin as well. Let's touch on how these voices have helped me grow, soften, and see the world differently. Specifically, like I had said about the teachers, they've really helped me lock in all of this information, whether it is, you know, singing, playing the piano, or knowing the base knowledge of music theory. And I absolutely am in debt to those people for that, especially the music people. You know, sometimes it's just through somebody posting a mix or somebody playing out or somebody sharing their own favorite tune that has kind of brought me into my own inspiration and inspired me to do something else. Let's touch on moments that have moved me and you, us. They can be moments that are big or small that sparked new energy or a new clarity. That can include hearing somebody's vulnerability, surprising piece of wisdom, a moment of shared laughter. We talked about that on the last episode. Laughter and comedy is the best, and having a shared moment of laughter is something that can move you. A turning point in a conversation, that can do that too. Whether it's something that you're just, you know, having a conversation with somebody and then you're like, ooh, ding, that light bulb goes off. That can be a little tiny bit of inspiration. And let's talk about honoring the conversations that have left a mark. Sometimes it's just meaningful dialogue that can change the trajectory of your day or your life that gives you that inspiration. I would like to bring up the subject matter of reflecting on the power of being seen and heard. That can also be a source of inspiration. And being seen and heard and the power of that, no matter who you are, the power of being seen and heard is immense. So if there is a moment where you felt powerful or felt the power of being seen and heard, I would love to hear about it. Again, I love to hear about all of these things from you guys. And then why do certain conversations stay with us long after they've ended? Was it a colorful story? Was it an inspirational story? Did it, make you then go from that conversation and go set up a strategy for yourself. I know I've had times where I've had a conversation with somebody and been like, ooh, okay, like I'm going to go and I'm going to try that as well. And that can be as simple as me talking with my client yesterday about making this wonderful thing called a taco ring. And that inspired me. I am going to go and make a taco ring, which sidebar, a taco ring is crescent rolls laid around with all the fixings for tacos put in the middle, folded over and baked. So again, that is just a little example of how a conversation can stay with us long after it's ended. I also want to start something in this episode, and we'll just kind of keep talking about it and kind of keep it up on the pages about gratitude spotlights. Dedicate space to acknowledging the people who show up consistently in your life, like you guys, listening and supporting the podcast, the guests as well. You got to make that space to acknowledge those people. So again, I personally right now would like to thank you, if you are listening, for showing up and supporting consistently and collaborating those people that have been on the show. If you're listening to this new episode, thank you so much, because you too have inspired me to there go do more things with the podcast. So I appreciate all of you. And again, we are going to continue to do the gratitude spotlight. So if there is somebody in your life or a moment or a story that you want to put in the gratitude spotlight, please message me. We'll get it on another future episode. Have you ever thought about inspiration having a ripple effect? Kind of just like a little drop of water, and then the ripples go outwards. How do people inspire you? What happens? Just having that moment of chit-chatting with somebody, and then that effect kind of inspiring you and having a ripple effect on you. Is it, you know, getting you to eat healthier? Is it getting you to try a cool new recipe like the taco ring? Is it inspiring you to create something, whether it's writing, artistically, musically? Those are all different ways that inspiration have a ripple effect, is hearing those things and it kind of just going throughout. And then just by you, you know, say maybe I go home after hearing the taco ring, make that taco ring and then bring it in. And then that inspires somebody else to do the same thing. And you never know how that ripple effect is going to go out and affect other. I also want to take some time to reflect on you as the listeners and how that affects me, and how the stories that you've shared with me, the times that I've had the people here in the studio and the stories that they've shared, that has effect on me. That's a smaller little effect, not smaller, but just another part of that ripple effect. And I want you to take time to reflect on who or what inspires you. Why do they inspire you? Whose voice can you honor today? What inspiration can you honor today? And just as a reminder, from my heart to yours, that inspiration is a practice, one rooted in connection, curiosity, and gratitude. And again, I just want to repeat, if there's anything that you want to share about someone or something that has inspired you, please do so. You can do that with all my social platforms. Or if you see me in person here on campus or out in the wild in real life, please do so. I love to hear about it. And with gratitude and appreciation, I have been inspired by you. So thank you for that. We grow through each other's voices, our stories, and courage. So continue to pay attention to those nudges and those little sparks of inspiration. And I look forward to chatting with you in the future on the next episode of Conversations with Kate.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Conversations with Kate. You can find more information on LCC Connect site, as well as all social platforms, Facebook, Instagram, yes, TikTok as well. Big love.
This is WLNZ, Lansing. You're listening to LCC Connect Weekly, a radio program from Lansing Community College's podcast network, LCC Connect. We feature more than 30 podcasts that explore education, culture, community, and our connection to the world. To listen on demand, find us at lccconnect.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.